listen, I'm the listener, I'm the resistor. Now I could be your next door neighbor who got by to ask a favor, who pretends to be your brother, or a member of the order who's a secret Sunday soldier from an underground militia. I might even be your butler or your chauffeur who just opened your car door. I'm the butcher, I'm the baker.
Well, good morning, boys and girls. Terrible Tommy here in the bunker. White Aryan Resistance radio calling. White Aryan Resistance radio calling. This is White Aryan Resistance Radio and Terrible Tommy right here in north central Indiana on a beautiful but cool day. It started out about 42 this morning. And I stepped out in the front patio and with my short shorts on, and that was an invigorating situation, man. We're at P.O. Box 401. As usual, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581, and that's where you send your donations for the show and other donations for other projects, such as sending money orders to the selected POWs, and also we send a certain amount of literature to other POWs that request it. They many times will send in a few stamps. And if they send in enough stamps and they're serious, well, we'll send them a book once in a while. And so that works out pretty good. So anyhow, it is September 23rd, 2014, Tears Day. I screwed up yesterday. We started doing the show with Stray Dog last Monday, and we're supposed to do one this Monday, but we didn't really tell each other that, and I forgot all about it. So we'll be back to doing Stray Dog next Monday. How about that? Somebody mentioned that these Sling Blade shows are not the old shows, but that they've heard before. So that's good. So many of them I'll be playing will be new ones. Not by actual date, because they are not dated, but shows that have not been played before. Back to this book that we've been reading and teaching from, and we're going to be discussing the Spanish-American War this morning, but this is from the book The War Myth in U.S. History by C.H. Hamlin. I was lucky enough to get one off the internet, another one, perfect condition. If someone would like to get a copy of it, just send me a donation, reasonable donation, and I'll send it to you. It's a book that I think everybody should have in their library, because instead of glorifying war, it shows all the problems and missteps and terrible things that happen in war. Well, along with that, when I did the Civil War, I think it was last Saturday, I mentioned that there's a good movie you should watch to understand what happens to the civilian population. Not only the soldiers, but the civilian population, and how brutal they were treated by these special, they're almost like Homeland Security rogues that go around and round up deserters from one army or the other. And it's called Cold Mountain. I think one gal got an Academy Award in that film. But if you haven't seen it, you want to know how ridiculous it is to have these kind of wars, because the suffering and horrible things that happen to the people, and there's so many bad things happen to the families, and then the wives are stuck, and the guys get their ass blown off, and here's the wife stuck there with kids and nothing to do about it, you know? And you can see that on Netflix. And you can probably rent it pretty easily at a movie rental store. Well, let's get back in the classroom, boys and girls, and continuing on in our book, the war myth in U.S. history. And today's lesson is the war with Spain. For almost a century, the Spanish possession of Cuba had been regarded with disfavor by certain elements in the United States. Reasons for this attitude varied from those of accusation on the grounds of manifest destiny to those of the highest altruism. When the Spanish-American republics won their independence during the early years of the 19th century, Puerto Rico and Cuba remained in the possession of Spain. Thomas Jefferson advocated the acquiring of Cuba and its annexation as a state, chiefly for fear that it would be acquired by England. Later, pro-slavery leaders wanted to take the island in order to extend the slave territory, as had been done in the case of Florida and Texas. Cuba's annexation was a part of the Manifest Destiny program, which was rampant in the years preceding Civil War. Many filibustering expeditions were sent there with annexation in view. The Cubans themselves often came to the United States, became naturalized citizens of this country, and would return to Cuba with an unfriendly attitude towards Spanish authority, counting for protection on their American citizenship in case of trouble. There's a lot of people doing that today from around the world. They're coming here and getting a citizenship, and then they go back like to the Middle East and cause trouble and raise hell, get killed, all that stuff, and we're supposed to go save them. Even ones that go to North Korea and all these different places. Most of them come here, get their citizenship, and then go where they shouldn't be. There had often been spasmodic rebellions or outbreaks in Cuba before 1895. In 1868, there broke out what is known as the 10 Years' War, which lasted until 1878. But the causes of these conflicts were never clearly understood by the participants on either side. Isn't that usual? People killing each other and they don't even know why. Sugar cane was the principal source of Cuban wealth. According to the customary policy of trade barriers, Spain imposed duties on goods coming from the United States, and the United States imposed high duties on Cuban sugar. Well, they should have outlawed sugar altogether. They'd have been much better off. These duties severely hurt Cuban economic life, and as economic depressions, as well as prosperities, are always attributed to the party in power, regardless of the real causes. The Cubans, no exceptions to this rule, blame the political power then in authority. During this 10 Years' War, many filibustering expeditions were secretly fitted out in the United States and for the Cubans. And in 1873, a ship, the Virginius, sailed under American colors carrying men and supplies to Cuban insurgents, was captured by a Spanish gunboat. In other words, we were interfering with the internal workings of Cuba and got caught. The crew and the passengers were given a trial which resulted in the execution of 53, of whom 8 claimed to be American citizens. See, there you got the non-white comes to the United States, gets citizenship, and then something goes wrong and he cries foul. I'm an American, you can't do this. Immediately, the war cry went up in the United States, but due to the wise policy of President Grant, it never gained headway. Finally, in 1878, Spain agreed to forget the past, abolish slavery in Cuba, and admit delegates from Cuba to the Spanish courts or parliament. The Cubans agreed and hostilities ceased. All men in Cuba were given the ballot if they paid taxes to the amount of $25 annually, which still excluded the poorer classes. Of the representatives sent by the island to the Spanish courts or parliament in Madrid, about one-fifth were Cuban-born. This arrangement lasted as long as the economic life of Cuba was normal. But in February 1895, a new war for independence broke out, which was caused by a severe depression of the sugar industry resulting from from the repeal in 1894 of the McKinley Tariff Act, which had permitted the free entry of Cuban sugar into the United States, giving the Cuban sugar industry access to the United States market. The closing of the United States to Cuban sugar was a great blow to Cuba's sugar industry. Spanish authority in Cuba was held responsible, and warfare was soon established between the insurgents and the Spanish authorities. A humane governor general tried to suppress the insurrection peaceably, but without satisfactory results. Accordingly, General Weyler became the governor general of Cuba on February 16, 1896, and inaugurated the concentration policy by which inhabitants of Cuba were assembled or crowded within certain military camps. For this, it was impossible to distinguish the loyalists from the insurgents. As a result of this, there was great suffering and destruction. Always meddling. Gomez was leader of the insurgents. He destroyed all the property he possibly could in an endeavor to compel the United States to intervene. By attempting to destroy Spanish authority, Gomez hoped to secure the help of the United States. The insurgents were often led by Cubans who had come to America, obtained United States citizenship, and returned to the island claiming the privilege of their acquired citizenship. You see how this causes a lot of trouble, and of course these may or may not have been white Cubans, maybe mixed breeds. Between February 24, 1895 and January 22, 1897, 74 persons claiming to be citizens of the United States were arrested by Spanish authority because of their activities as insurgents. You see, nothing ever changes. Same shit. They do that. There's thousands of these people that come to the United States, get a citizenship, and then go abroad causing trouble. But fully three-fourths of those arrested were Cubans or sons of Cubans who had been naturalized in the United States. Often the insurgents developed their plans on American soil and secured military aid here. Sounds like Castro's Cuba, right? Remember when the CIA and the Bay of Pigs invasion, all that? And all those Cubans in Florida were helping them get guns and everything. These are things a country doesn't need. They should have just left Cuba go. And until it finally decided it had enough of Castro. But our meddling with them and embargoing them and blockading them has caused more trouble than it solved. The federal government took precautions to prevent this, but many expeditions were made in spite of action taken to prevent them. Our Department of State protested to Spain against the concentration policy in Cuba carried out under Governor General Weyler, but Spain contended that her methods in suppressing rebellion in Cuba were no more severe than the methods employed by our federal government during the Civil War. Attention was called by Spain to the Sherman March through the South and to Sheridan's activities in Virginia. Spain also called attention to the Cuban junta in New York and claimed that the principal insurgent assistance came from American soil. Congress appropriated $50,000 for the relief of Americans in Cuba. But up to the fall of 1897, only $6,000 of the $50,000 had been used, so little need was there for it. In this war, Cuba, between the insurgents or rebels and Spanish authority, both sides destroyed all the property possible, although the insurgents destroyed more than the Spanish authorities. It was not nearly so destructive as our Civil War, yet what should we have thought had Spain protested against the conditions of our Civil War? Penn calling the pot black, right? Such a protest would have been treated with contempt. Well, that's because we're all, U.S. is always right and everybody else is always wrong. We have no more legal ground for questioning Spanish authority in Cuba than Japan today would have in questioning or protesting against our policy in the Philippines. In fact, 2 years later, in our guerrilla warfare with the natives of the Philippines, we adopted the same concentration policy, as we shall see, against which we then protested to Cuba. William Randolph Hearst, who was then the leader of the American Yellow Journalism, had at this time developed his chain of newspapers from California to Boston. Also remember, Hearst was, as I recall, the big guy behind making hemp or marijuana illegal. Early in 1897, he began advocating intervention. Fine for him. Appeals were made daily. Stories, crimes, and conditions were pictured in his papers and greatly exaggerated. What's new? Just like with this ISIS deal right now. They're getting us all set for war. More war. More war. Mr. McKinley, opposed to intervention, became president on March 4, 1897. Mark Hanna, who had elected Mr. McKinley president, now wished to be compensated by an appointment to the United States Senate from Ohio. To create a vacancy in the Senate, Mr. McKinley appointed as his Secretary of State Mr. John Sherman, who was then Senator from Ohio, and Mr. Hanna was appointed to the Governor of Ohio to the United States Senate. Mr. McKinley appointed appointment of John Sherman as Secretary of State was a great blunder. Mr. Sherman was then very old and rapidly declining. His work was left in the hands of his assistants in the Department of State. United States citizens owned wealth in Cuba to the amount of $50 million, and our commerce with Cuba amounted to $100 million annually. These interests, of course, demanded intervention, you see. The ruling class, the money class, rich man's war, poor man's fight. Our Department of State, in its correspondence with Spain, estimated that $16 million worth of American property had been destroyed in Cuba at the close of 1897, for which property Spain was held responsible. This was a greatly exaggerated figure, for at the close of the war, a claims commission was created by Congress to investigate those claims, and the commission recognized as valid claims amounting to only $362,000. That's a lot of difference, isn't it? In October 1897, Spain recalled Governor General Weyler and appointed in his place Blanco. The concentration order was revoked. Spain offered the natives a larger share of self-government with their own constitution and legislature. Autonomy was granted. If it had been offered 3 years before, this would no doubt have solved the problem, but now it was difficult to reconcile the two factions in Cuba. The native Spaniards in Cuba opposed home rule, as it would give the Cubans too much power. The Cubans wanted independence and were unwilling to cooperate with the Spaniards in home rule. A Cuban parliament was called on May 4, 1898. The Hearst newspapers were then demanding intervention on the part of the United States and molding public opinion in that direction. Warmongers. Although the election of 1896 was over and it had settled the issue of free silver, yet other social elements had entered American politics through the election and campaign of 1896, and it was in the interest of some people to make use of a vigorous foreign policy to keep public attention away from the new issues. This is an old device for obliterating home issues or differences. Yeah, let's have an external war. Then people will forget about internal problems. Lincoln had been advised to precipitate the United States into a foreign war as a means of preventing the Civil War. On February 9, 1898, the New York Journal a strong advocate of intervention, violated the sanctity of the United States mails by securing through criminal means a private letter written by Loam, the Spanish minister in Washington, to a friend. In this letter, Loam severely criticized McKinley and spoke of him with contempt. This letter was published in the New York Journal. It excited public opinion and was, of course, made use by the Jingo Press. However, it had nothing to do with the case, for a foreign minister naturally has a perfect legal and moral right to have any opinion of the president or any other public official that he likes, and to express it privately to a friend. The actual crime was in stealing the letter from the United States mail, but that action was never investigated or punished by the United States, which should have done so. Loam's criticism of McKinley may have been unjust, but he had a personal right to do it. In the midst of the great excitement created by that Loam letter, another incident took place of advantage to the war party. On January 24, 1898, the Maine was ordered to Cuba on a friendly visit. This trip was accepted officially as a complimentary visit, but privately, both Spain and the United States regarding it in the opposite light. After being in Havana Harbor for 3 weeks, the Maine was blown up on February 15, 1898. Quote, "Remember the Maine," unquote, now became the slogan of the war party. Spain denied any connection with its destruction. Now you can imagine who had the most to gain at this time for that ship blowing up. And no one now believes it was blown up by Spain. The actual cause of the explosion is not known. But it is now believed to have been done by the rebels in Cuba for the purpose of securing intervention of the United States. It may have been an accident, which Spain could in no way be connected. Yet at the time, the eyes of the public, Spain was held responsible. McKinley during this period opposed intervention, but the war party, supported by Hearst papers, newspapers, was growing rapidly. See, the same thing today. You see, the newspapers and television. Our able minister in Spain, General Wolford, was also opposed to our intervention. Congress, however, held the opposite attitude. A senator said to the Assistant Secretary of State, Day, quote, "Day, doesn't your president know where the war-declaring power is lodged? Tell him that if he doesn't do something, Congress will exercise the power," unquote. Congressman Buttel, who was opposed to the war, says that 40 or 50 Republican members of Congress held a caucus and sent a committee to the president stating that unless he asked for a declaration of war, they would propose a resolution for war and carry it through, which there was no need for a war. And probably U.S. CIA-type people blew that Maine up. Secretary of War Alger, who was a notorious spoilsman, said to a senator, quote, "I want you to advise the president to declare war. He's making a great mistake. He is in danger of ruining himself and the Republican Party by standing in the way of the people's wishes." Yeah, the people who've been propagandized, brainwashed by the Hearst newspapers. "Congress will declare war in spite of him. He'll get run over and the party with him." Rhodes, in, quote, "McKinley and Roosevelt Administrations," on page 64, says McKinley feared a rupture in his own party, and on account of that fear, had not the nerve and power to resist the pressure for war. In other words, they went to war simply over internal politics, nothing to do with any real threat in Cuba or Spain. We may rest assured that if Mark Hanna had been president, there would have been no war in Spain, with Spain. McKinley was opposed to the war up to the last of March 1898. Only two members of his cabinet were in favor of war. Also, the vice president was against it, and was Mark Hanna, the Speaker of the House, and nearly all the leading Republicans of the Senate. On March 29, 1898, McKinley sent his ultimatum to Spain demanding the complete abandonment of the concentration policy, the granting of an armistice to Cuba, and the opening of peace negotiations through himself, with the insurgents. Spain replied granting the complete abandonment of the concentration policy and did not refuse to grant the armistice, but told our minister, General Wolford, that she would gladly grant it if the Cubans, who were the resistors, asked for it, for Spain could not first offer it. Our minister at Madrid then cabled McKinley that the Spanish government and the people wished to settle the difficulty without war, and that in a few months' time he would get peace in Cuba with justice. Cuba and the protection of our great American interests. Let us say, for example, that Japan had sent an ultimatum to McKinley during the Philippine insurrection, demanding that he change his policy of coercion and grant an armistice to the Philippines. Such a demand would have been treated with contempt. Yet, that is what we demanded of Spain. On April 6, 1898, the representatives of Great Britain, Germany, France, Austria, Russia, and Italy made an appeal to McKinley to continue peaceful negotiations. The Pope also intervened for peace. He asked the Queen of Spain to comply fully with our ultimatum. Accordingly, on April 10th, McKinley was notified by the Foreign Office at Madrid that Spain would grant the armistice. But on the following day, Monday, April 11th, 1898, McKinley appeared before Congress and asked for a declaration of war against Spain, without informing them of the latest concessions made by Spain. It is impossible to explain McKinley's action. Through the efforts of Minister Wolford at Madrid and others, a diplomatic victory had been won only to be thrown away by McKinley and Congress. Well, you know what it was. It was the moneyed interest, the powered interest, and the media that pushed him into war and party politics. The Spanish minister at Washington was notified that the president, in his message to Congress on April 11th, would explain the concession made by Spain, but this was not done. A reference only was made to it in his war message. War was declared on April 18th by a vote of 324-19 in the House and 67-21 in the Senate. On March 31st, 1898, Wolford had cabled to McKinley, quote, "I believe the ministry are ready to go as far as and as fast as they can and still save the dynasty here in Spain. They know that Cuba is lost. Public opinion in Spain has moved steadily towards peace," unquote. Then on April 3, 1898, Wolford sent this message to President McKinley, quote, "The Spanish Minister for Foreign Affairs assures me that Spain will go as far as and as fast as she can. I know that the Queen and her present ministry sincerely desire peace, and that the Spanish people desires peace, and if you can still give me time and reasonable liberty of action, I am sure that before next October 1st, I will get peace in Cuba," unquote. But you see, the war power, the warmongers in the United States, didn't want peace. And again on April 10th, the day before our declaration of war, Wolford notified our Department of State that before August 1st, he could secure autonomy for Cuba, or a recognition of its independence by Spain, or a cession of the island to the United States. He then added, quote, "I hope that nothing will be done to humiliate Spain, as I am satisfied the present government is going and is loyally ready to go as fast as far as it can," unquote. It was an open secret that Spain would give up or sell Cuba as soon as she could. One cannot read the Woodford dispatches and fail to see that the Spanish-American War was thrust upon Spain by our jingo press and, of course, weak, rich-serving leaders like the President McKinley. McKinley overestimated its strength and lost his nerve, fearing the disruption of his party. Spain was not surprised but stunned when the United States declared war, a war which cannot be defended on any grounds. Cuba was Spanish territory, and we had no more legal right to intervene than Spain. For example, had a right to demand that the United States change their methods of government in Alaska. Morally, the war was indefensible, for Spain was conceding and was ready to go to any extent to avoid war, even to the point of granting independence to Cuba. This conflict with Spain cost $300 million, not including the indirect expenses, and then think of all the population that were harmed and killed. The most important result of the war was our acquisition of the Philippine Islands. As a side issue, after the so-called Spanish-American War, tracts of land in California over towards Arizona were ceded to veterans coming back from the Spanish-American War in Imperial County, where there's some very rich farmland. But when they went to get their land, most of them didn't get anything. And they did the same thing in World War I and even World War II. So the government lies to everybody. In February 1898, about 2 months before the war was declared, Admiral Dewey of the American fleet was ordered to Hong Kong, China, and instructed to be prepared to begin operations against the Philippines in case of a declaration of war. And, of course, the Philippines should have been left to be independent, too. Until after the Battle of Manila, the American people had practically never heard of the Philippine Islands. These islands were taken, however, and at the peace conference, now just think of all these Americans that died fighting the Huks in the Philippines, who were really tough characters. Mr. McKinley instructed our commissioners not to be satisfied with anything less than the entire group of islands because of the commercial opportunity. The real reason behind taking. They were secured as a trading base in the Orient. Also, the .45 caliber pistol was created for the war in the Philippines because the army was going up against the Huks, this indigenous group of fighters over there, and they were carrying .38s, or smaller caliber weapons, and it was really hard to kill these Huks coming at them, because the Huks were getting high on dope, and I understand they even put a band around their testicles and squeezed them tight and all that kind of stuff too. So when they charged like berserkers, and the sidearms and so forth that the American Army was carrying wouldn't stop them. Sort of like a big crack nigger in L.A. I mean, you could shoot him with a .38. The cops used a shoot him with a .38, but before they died, they could strangle the cop, because even with the heart with a bullet right through the heart, they keep moving. So they had to, that's why they went to the 9mm Glocks. Anyhow, this was our first step in a policy of imperialism, clothed in mild terms. For 3 years after our capture of these islands, the natives put up a guerrilla warfare to resist the United States forces. During this period, the American Army resorted to every description of barbaric torture. Among other measures, the policy of concentrating the inhabitants in camps was resorted to, which was the same policy we objected to use by Spain and Cuba, and, of course, later in time, National Socialist Germany. Where did they learn that stuff? Where did the Nazis learn that stuff in Germany? They learned it from us and the British. They used the same policy against the Boers in South Africa. Prisoners of war were executed in retaliation for crimes of which they knew nothing. One of our notorious army officers, known as Hell-Roaring Jake Smith, commanded that every building in a certain area be burned and every native over 10 years of age killed. These 3 years of guerrilla warfare cost the United States $170 million. All of this cost and cruelty, aside from being unjust, was unnecessary, for the natives of the Philippines were willing to cooperate with the United States to develop their civilization by peaceful methods. The resistance was caused by the presence of United States soldiers in the islands. And that, I think that's it for today. So you see what's been going on? We didn't just start being, you know, our government didn't just start being assholes. They've been assholes from the very beginning. And if, you got to be saying, hey, boy, that guy's a progressive. Well, what if it's true, it's true. And these people all over the world now harbor and have harbored for a long time dislike of the United States. And we say, well, we do them such good and we loan them money and we do all this stuff and they should love us. They should love us. Well, tomorrow we'll finish up with the World War One, and in other words, the war to end all wars. Yeah, you know. So we're run by the same kind of megalomaniacs and sociopaths out of the Pentagon, just like always. So when are we going to stop doing that? Anybody saying, well, we got to protect the white race? Well, quit going into goddamn wars and quit going over to countries and occupying countries where we don't belong. That's the first way to start saving white lives and saving the white race is kill the imperialism. This is not constitutionalist. This is imperialism. And we've been an imperialist country for quite a long time. So anyhow, that's the end of my reading for today. Tomorrow we'll go into the First World War. It's even much worse. So you see, much of what the liberals or progressives say are true about the imperialist actions of the United States for a long time. But the neocons, they jump right up and say, oh, you guys are communists, you're anti-American, you're not pro-American if you're not for the war and all that kind of stuff, which has nothing to do with saving the white race or advancing the white race. In fact, it degrades and destroys the white race. So you're going to have to get a lot of your information, not just from, well, I hate to even say the right anymore because I don't trust hardly anything the right say anymore. You're going to have to bite the bullet and get a lot of your information through the liberals and the progressives, even though they're dead wrong on the race issue. They're dead right on a whole lot of other issues, especially this imperialist type of belligerent let's go to war attitude. So you'll find a lot of people in the right wing will be condemning Tom Metzger. Oh, my God, he's going over to the commies or something. But no, if I find the truth on the left, I'll use it. If I find the truth on the right, I'll use it. I'm not bound by either wing. Like I say, I'm going to try to give you an MP3 file on what the hell's going on with this continually trying to bait Russia into some kind of an international hot war again. They're desperately trying to drag Russia into this thing, and it's so obvious that it's unbelievable, as obvious as most of these stories that I've read you out of this book. And I'm telling you, they keep pushing Russia. They're not pushing Iraq. They're not pushing Afghanistan. They're pushing a country that's got probably as many nukes as we do. And nukes are definitely not good for the white race. Well, last night, a CBS News reporter up in Alaska, I believe it was, said, fuck it, and walked off the job. And, hey, she's black. I give her a lot of credit for it. Let's see if I can play this for you.
Now, everything you've heard is why I, the actual owner of the Alaska Cannabis Club, will be dedicating all of my energy toward fighting for freedom and fairness, which begins with legalizing marijuana here in Alaska. And as for this job, well, not that I have a choice, but fuck it, I quit. All right, we apologize for that. We'll be right back.
In other words, they tell them how to mismanage the news and expect everybody just to follow their orders, and almost all of them do, but this black gal told them off. She says she got it pretty well figured out. Okay, I'm sending you that clip and the video on that particular story. You want to see it. Well, there's something strange here in the Jewish press. They're talking about all the Jews fleeing eastern Ukraine and headed towards Kiev. Alexander Zadov recalls the last time the war forced him out of his home in Donetsk. The year was 1941, and German troops were occupying the eastern Ukrainian city. He and his parents escaped under the cover of darkness to Kazakhstan. We lived in a savage, barbaric conditions, but we survived and came back. The 77-year-old says he reaches out to hold his wife Bella's hand. Quote, I would never have guessed that at our age we would have to deal with this again. The Jewish couple fled war-torn Donetsk in mid-July, living first in a ramshackle house in Lviv in the west of the country before relocating to Kiev in early August. We speak in a guest house besides the elaborately restored Great Choral Synagogue in the capital's historic Jewish quarter, Padil. Dozens of Jewish internally displaced people from eastern Ukraine have come through the guest house in recent weeks. I asked the Zadovs what they plan to do next. To go home, of course, Bella says, in a slight waver in her voice. She speaks to the diaphanous floral blouse she is wearing. And we didn't bring anything with us. Now, don't this sound a little screwy? There's supposed to be neo-Nazis all over fighting on the side of Kiev. And, of course, they wouldn't be too happy about having Jews. Now, here's the Jews fleeing eastern Ukraine back over into Kiev. This don't make sense. Does it make sense to you? Reading on here, it says, but going home looks increasingly unlikely as the carnage continues in eastern Ukraine. Well, yeah, but isn't that a lot of the Kiev troops doing that stuff, the carnage? This is all geared against the Russians. Despite the signing earlier this month of a ceasefire between Ukrainian government forces and the pro-Russian separatists, the death toll from the conflict has now reached 3,000. The United Nations says Donetsk, a once thriving industrial city with a population of 1 million, is eerily empty, while the cities of Luhansk remains besieged with tens of thousands living in basements without working phones, electricity, or running water. Lawlessness abounds in both eastern regions. The Ukraine's 70,000-strong Jewish community, the world's 11th largest, let's see here, 11th largest, is undergoing what members described as the biggest upheaval since the Second World War, while most of the country's Jews live in Kiev. Up to a fifth reside, at least until recently, into the conflict hit east. Convinced that they would return home after the fighting ended, many now face the brutal reality of all-out war on Europe's fringes. Some are settling elsewhere in their Ukraine, while others are immigrating to Israel. The International Fellowship of Christians and Jews estimates that more Ukrainian Jews will make Allah to Israel this year than in the last 3 years combined. Through September 1, 2014, 3,252 Jews had relocated to Israel from the Ukraine, compared to 1,982 in 2013, according to IFCJ, which helps foot the bill for the move, and probably mostly Christian money. In 2012, that number was 2,030. The IFCJ expects to spend some $2 million this year on securing plane tickets to Israel and predicts the number of immigrants could hit 7,000. And, of course, most of this money is coming from U.S. Christian Zionists. Yekel Eckstein, the organization's founder, told me by telephone from Jerusalem, under Israel's law of return, any Jew in the world is entitled to Israeli citizenship. That's going to come back someday to bite him in the ass. They're running out of room. The war in eastern Ukraine has displaced 1 million people. United Nations reports Moscow claims the vast majority, some 814,000, have gone to Russia, where they have family and friends. Wait a minute. Okay. Keep up with me, boys. An additional 260,000 are displaced within their own country. The consequences of this displacement, Antonio Guterres, the UN's High Commission for Refugees, recently warned, has the potential to destabilize the whole region. Jews in particular have a long and complicated history with Ukraine, having first arrived in the medieval state of Kievan Rus as traders. Don't they always? They were later pushed into the Pale of the Settlement, a chunk of Imperial Russia that Catherine the Great carved out in 1791, which encompassed most of the present-day Ukraine, and dumped all the Jews in there. Despite repeated persecution in subsequent centuries, Jews generally prospered. They made up a third of Ukraine's urban population before the Second World War, when 900,000 Ukrainian Jews were killed, allegedly. Such history partly explains why the recent upheaval is so harrowing for Ukraine's Jew community, much of which was painstakingly revived in the 1990s after the fall of communism. Well, it goes on and on, but my question is this: if we got neo-Nazis fighting on the side of Kiev, running all over the place, and we got Jews that are fleeing towards them back into Kiev, what kind of Nazis are these? These are phony Hollywood Nazis. That's unbelievable. Well, anyhow, whenever the Jews run into trouble, they can run right to Israel if they can get out of the area, and they have Israeli citizenship. Now, where are you going to go, white man? You white non-Jews, when the shit collapses, if it collapses, where are you going to go? Where can you go to another country and just walk in into a mainly white country and have a citizenship? But boy, they go on and on and on about Jews. Now, it says here that roughly 60 IDPs from Luhansk, meanwhile, have found temporary refuge in an IFCJ Christian-funded settlement in Shapola. Now, there's a whole lot of displaced persons in eastern Ukraine that are not Jews. Where are they setting up places for them? A townlet steeped in Jewish history and 50 miles southwest of Cherkasy, the revered Soviet poet Isaac Pfeffer, who wrote in Yiddish, was born there in 1900, 5 decades later. Joseph Stalin had him killed in Moscow's notorious Lubyanka prison. Well, anyhow, the Jews are being taken care of as best possible with infusions of Christian Zionist money from Europe and the United States. But what about the Aryan people? What about the white non-Jews in eastern Ukraine? What a mess. And, you know, I don't see these Zionist Christians setting up camps for non-Jews in Ukraine. Screw you. Screw you, white people. We're going to take care of the kikes, because the baby Jesus will love us if we do and give us a special place at the right hand of the great Jehovah. Now, it shows some pictures of the dwellings at this camp the Christians and Jews set up. Pretty damn nice houses. They moved them all over into central Ukraine out of harm's way, or most harm's way. Families of this person are all too aware of their relatively good fortune in getting out of Luhansk and getting to this Christian financed haven in the middle of the Ukraine. Quote, "We're happy we're Jews," says Lydia Raviva, 43, who came to the camp with her three of her six children on the 1st of August, leaving their home in Luhansk, town of Bryanka. Quote, "We're in better situation than the Ukrainians, than those we left behind," unquote. She tells me this as her family sits down to eat in the camp's cobalt blue painted canteen. See, isn't that nice? Isn't that nice? They're a lot better shape than the non-Jews in eastern Ukraine. And I don't see anything about crying about any persecution by the neo-Nazis that are working over there in the western part and even central part of Ukraine. What is this? A bunch of bullshit as far as I'm concerned. Well, here's some good news. Abortion's racial gap, even as the U.S. abortion rate is at its lowest since Roe versus Wade, women of color are 5 times as likely to terminate a pregnancy as their white counterparts. Interesting. About 1.1 million abortions were performed in 2011 at the rate of 16.9 abortions for every 1,000 women of childbearing age, down from a peak of 29.3 per thousand in 1981. Since the report's release in February, the reason why has been the subject of much debate. Its authors and abortion rights supporters point to the increase in contraceptive use and sexual education, while anti-abortion activists counter that the decrease is a result of abstinence, only teachings the state restrictions. I don't think it's abstinence. Yeah, right. Largely missing from the debate, though, is the discussion of abortion's racial disparity. Although rates among Hispanics and African Negro women have decreased along with the rest of the country, they remain significantly higher than the national average. Christine Dahlendorf, a professor of family community medicine at the University of California, San Francisco, who specializes in reproductive health research, said the discrepancy is reflective of broader inequities people of color face in every arena. They're so discriminated against. Quote, "There are a multitude of reasons, and we don't fully understand what's going on," Dahlendorf said. "But ultimately, I think it's about structural determinants, economic reasons, issues related to racism, differences in opportunities, differences in social and historical context." She emphasized that money is often a decisive factor. The median wealth of white households is 18 times that of Hispanic households and 20 times that of black households. You see, the Hispanics are almost ahead of the blacks already. According to the Pew Research Center, but across the board, low-income women have a higher rate of unintended pregnancy and abortion regardless of race. Well, that's enough of that. You get the idea, boys and girls. We may have a reversal on a conviction of a guy in Brooklyn, New York, Donald Kagan, 40, the white man whose 1999 murder conviction for killing a black man was thrown into doubt last year when the judge who found him guilty said the judge, based his verdict on his own reverse racism. Won't be revealed until Kagan can be produced in court next week before a black female judge. It's going to be interesting what happens there, whether she's going to rule overturn a conviction or not, but based upon the testimony of this ex-Supreme Court judge, I would say she should. We'll have to wait and see. Now, the black female judge says it's a complicated case. It's one of those heart-wrenching cases. Acting Brooklyn Supreme Court Judge Shandaya Simpson, black, told the Post after she adjourned the case. Quote, "This one has really been wearing me down. I've been reading and reading and reading," unquote. The judge said that she had already written her decision. quote, "I'm done. I just want him here in the courtroom," Simpson said during a brief court hearing referring to Kagan. Quote, "I had no idea the defendant wasn't going to be here today." So, it's going to be sort of interesting the way they turn out. She's already got a decision made, but she's going to wait till she pulls this Kagan back into court. Retired, as the Post first reported, retired Brooklyn Supreme Court Judge Frank Barbaro, 86, testified last December that he wanted Kagan to be freed because he based his verdict in the non-jury trial on his own anti-white prejudice. Quote, "Mr. Kagan had no intent to kill that man. I believe now that I was seeing this young white fellow as a bigot, as someone who assassinated an African American," unquote, Barbaro testified. Simpson adjourned the case until October 1st, at which point she'll reveal her decision on whether she'll overturn Kagan's conviction, grant him a new trial, or reject his appeal and leave him to the mercy of the parole board. Kagan is eligible for parole in November, so keep your eyes on that. And this is from the New York Post, and if I don't see it, let me know what happens in this case. If you get the New York Post. Me, like the judge, is a little bit senile myself. He came out and upheld the conviction and then comes back and say, well, he was prejudiced against the white guy. I mean, come on. Well, I see the military-industrial complex and the Pentagon are talking about these strikes today they did in Syria, blowing the crap out of a whole bunch of real estate, saying this is going to be a long, long war. Well, here we go again.
You can turn back now or learn the stuff they don't want you to know. Here are the facts. Although Edward Bernays is little known today, his work speaks for itself. In an earlier episode, we explored Bernays' campaign to popularize smoking among women, but this wasn't his only project. He's the reason Americans eat eggs and bacon for breakfast. Before Bernays, most Americans ate a light breakfast. In the 1950s, the Beech Nut Packing Company contracted Bernays to expand sales of bacon. Instead of attacking other bacon companies, Bernays courted experts. He wrote a carefully worded letter to 5,000 physicians asking them whether a hearty breakfast was better than a light one. The results made headlines. More than 4,500 doctors recommended a hearty breakfast and specifically mentioned bacon and eggs. Bernays' plan was a success. Business owners across the United States took notice, and they weren't the only ones. In fact, Bernays worked for the United States both before and during his corporate campaigns. However, they didn't pay him to sell bacon or cigarettes. They paid him to sell wars. Here's where it gets crazy. In 1917, President Woodrow Wilson formed the Committee on Public Information, or CPI, which raised support for U.S. engagement in World War I. Bernays worked for the organization, which was headed by George Creel. They briefed President Wilson, directing him in the use of propaganda. The CPI hired thousands of four-minute men, speakers who were trained to speak about the war for 4 minutes during community events. The men at CPI believed that the average attention span was about 4 minutes. Bernays' work was successful, and the United States eventually did enter World War I. His work didn't stop there. Over the years, Bernays consulted with other presidents, Eisenhower, Hoover, and more, while continuing to consult with businesses. Often his client base overlapped in strange ways. When the United Fruit Company was unhappy with the democratic government of Guatemala in the 1950s, they first pulled strings with the U.S. Embassy. Under the previous dictatorship, United Fruit had enormous control over the country. They had tax exemptions, a large degree of autonomy, and controlled the country's railroad and post office. Yet the new presidents refused to support United Fruit's control of the nation. They also allowed the Communist Party to operate openly. Unfortunately for those presidents and Guatemala, United Fruit had high-level connections. Alan Dulles, the director of Central Intelligence, was a stakeholder in United Fruit, and his brother, John Foster Dulles, was Secretary of State. But United Fruit still needed to convince Congress and the American public, so they hired Edward Bernays. Bernays persuaded Congress and the administration that attacks on United Fruit were proof of communist subversion, and that President Arbenz was a communist himself. According to the CIA report, he sent correspondents from Time, Newsweek, The New York Times, and Chicago Tribune to report on communist activities in Guatemala. As the coup took place, Bernays persuaded the American public that the CIA-backed military juntas were actually freedom fighters stopping the spread of communism. Bernays' work paved the way from the 1954 coup of Guatemala, which triggered a civil war that would last for 4 decades. By the time this war ended, hundreds of thousands had died. Bernays' work attracted several notable fans, including Nazi propagandist Joseph Goebbels, who based his strategies on Bernays' theories. This isn't to say that Bernays was necessarily a bad man, just very, very good at what he did. And Goebbels wasn't the only person to copy Bernays' work. PR agencies across the planet use Bernays' techniques every day, influencing your opinion about products, countries, and of course, politics. But who's paying them to influence you, and why? That is something they don't want you to know. Tune in next week to learn more about the legacy of Edward Bernays and how the same propaganda techniques are being used on you today.
Well, have you had enough education for today? I think you've got quite a bit to mull over here and decide, are you a part of the neocon, right-wing, warmongering set? Are you among the people who want to really save the white race by keeping our ass out of all these phony wars, corporate wars, religious wars, and so forth? That's it for today. Terrible Tommy is off and clear. 14-5, and don't forget, shut up. If you don't have a warrant, I ain't going with you.
The Cuban shore, call it peace.